Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we are celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we are just getting started. Find us at heritageradio.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this trip through culinary history. And today's journey is a bit of recent culinary history in Ireland. It was 30 years ago this month that the acclaimed cooking series Simply Delicious with Doreena Allen debuted on Ireland's TV network and catapulted the chef and cooking instructor to world culinary fame. In addition to being a beloved food personality, Doreena Allen is Ireland's best-known food ambassador, tirelessly campaigning for the quality ingredients and local produce upon which her recipes are based in her 17 books. It's the philosophy that she teaches to people around the world who flock to her classes at the renowned Ballymaloe Cookery School in Shanagarry, County Cork. In celebration of the TV cooking show's anniversary, she and her publishers, Kyle Books, have come out with her latest book called Simply Delicious, the Classic Collection. 100 timeless, tried, and tested recipes, released just in time for St. Patrick's Day. Earlier this week, Doreena and I had a wonderful conversation following a cooking demonstration and luncheon for her book, hosted by Tourism Ireland, and I invite you to listen. Doreena, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to see you once again. You've been on the show a couple of times before, but this is a very auspicious time because 30 years ago this week, you aired your very first cooking show, which was called
Simply Delicious.
Simply Delicious.
My goodness, 30 years, really. Yes. I hadn't registered that. Thank you for reminding me.
And time flies, right?
Big celebration.
Absolutely. Yeah. 30 years. Tell me a little bit about what you feel has transpired in 30 years. What was the cooking scene like then? I mean, there were very few cooking shows on television. No wonder you're called the Julia Child of Irish television. I mean, you and Julia. I mean, it was, the field was not as cluttered as it is. Not cluttered, but busy
well,
as it is.
Well,
now.
Absolutely. And there was no such thing as celebrity chefs then, really. No. I mean, I think the reason why I was asked to do a series on Irish television was because they didn't have any Irish person on Irish television at that time. Monica Sheridan had been before me, and then there was a sort of gap. So, and they contacted me and asked whether I would do first a pilot, and then they must have thought there was some kind of potential there. And then they asked me to do a series. And what on earth would it be called? And I kept saying, as I tried to push more and more into each program, oh, we must do that. It's Simply Delicious. And eventually my producer said, well, look, let's just call it that. And in a way, my food has always been very simple. I take lovely fresh ingredients that are in season at the time, and this was indeed 30-something years ago, and just cook them simply so that they taste delicious. So when people sit down at the table, they go, oh, wow, this tastes really good. And then the other thing that was really important to me always was, of course, there was a book with each series, Simply Delicious, and that the recipes were really well tested so that when people, when they saw it on television and then went into the kitchen to reproduce it, it really did turn out brilliantly for them.
You know, it's interesting, a few of us sitting at the luncheon that you were so graciously doing a demonstration for and the Irish Tourism Board hosting, that was the discussion we had during our lunch, was all those of us involved in the food world and food writing, was how often the frustration of getting recipes that have never been tested. And That's very important.
Yeah, it's really important. And I just feel, as a cookery writer and a food writer, that I really have a responsibility to people, particularly nowadays when a lot of people actually don't cook and haven't got the fundamentals, and they pick up the courage to go out and get the ingredients and then to make a dish. And it's just so not fair when a recipe is not properly tested, so that then they think they've got it wrong and that they can't. Well, can't cook. A lot of the time when people say to me, I can't cook, and I say, well, have you got a recipe book that actually works, you know? Yeah. And that's a real help, because it turns people off to think, well, I can't cook. And it probably often isn't them. It's just the recipe.
Well, now your new book is basically a celebration of that 30 years, because it's, what do we call it? The Simply
it's,
Delicious.
It's called Simply Delicious, 100 Classic Recipes.
Classic Recipes.
Yeah, and it was really difficult to pick out just 100 recipes from the, I think, 9 Simply Delicious little paperbacks that I did. But you see, they've been out of print, those little paperbacks, for about 12 years. And almost hardly a week went by without somebody contacting me and saying, well, look, where can I get a copy of Simply Delicious Food for Family and Friends, or Simply Delicious Christmas, or Simply Delicious Fish, or something? And I'd say, well, look, you'll have to look in a charity shop or something. And because people would say, look, I lent my copy to my friend and she never gave it back to me, or blah, 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 something like that. And they say, well, we're looking for one for our son or daughter. I want to give it as a present. And then so my publishers, Octopus, Kyle Books, they said, well, look, we should really do a reprint and just pick 100 of the favorites.
And so how in the world...
Sorry,
did you pick just 100 recipes out of all the... Because the show ran for how long? How long did the show run?
Well, there were 9 series, basically.
9 series that lasted over...
There were 9 series. And so it was really tough to pick just 100 recipes. And we may even do a sequel to this, because when it... You see, there was such a nostalgic thing about the Simply Delicious books. And when it was republished for this last Christmas in Ireland, people just flocked into the shops to get a copy again. And so because these... You know, Simply Delicious for many people in Ireland is what memories are made of. It really is.
Well, in looking through this book that has just come out, The Simply Delicious, the 100 recipes that you've chosen, The classics.
Yes.
And people may say, well, gee, this is interesting. It's sort of like very simple, classic home cooking.
My food has always been simple and sort of what people might call nowadays pareback food, but it's a sort of food that people want to eat every day and that they want to, and that indeed they can serve to their family and to friends when they come to dinner and share with them again. So there was one lovely thing about this. The whole book was re-photographed again, and I did some little tweaks to the recipes to make them a little bit more contemporary and so on. But basically the home economist and the food stylist and the photographer who were photographing the book, you know, they do books all the time and so on, but they said to me, look, we couldn't get over how well these recipes have stood the test of time, because they couldn't, wasn't that a compliment?
That's impressive.
Isn't that nice?
Absolutely.
And they kept saying, well, we couldn't wait to photograph them to eat the dishes afterwards. And it's not always their experience, you know. So that was really nice to discover that the recipes are still so relevant and so much loved. And it's all about starting off with really good produce. It's just real food. I mean, this is what people are still craving.
Well, and you were, you've always been a proponent of quality ingredients and local whenever available.
Yes.
And
oh,
the slow
yes.
food movement.
Yes.
Right?
And also actually really encouraging people. You know, in a way, you're asking about what's happened in those 30 years. I mean, look at what's happened. We have handed over practically total responsibility for the food we eat to the supermarkets and the multinational food companies. I mean, what are we like? I mean, how do we expect them to have our best interests at heart? It's not their responsibility.
That's right.
You know, their responsibility is to their shareholders. So I keep saying to people, look, take back control over the food you're eating again. Really think about what you're putting into that basket when you're shopping and when you're and what you're going to feed to your family and so on. And basically, you know, and I say to people, look, where do you live? I don't care whether you live in the country or in a city. Try to grow something again. You know, discover the magic of growing a little of your own food. Even with all you need to grow food is to have some kind of container. It could be a recycled box or a basket or something. You need some soil, you need a seed, you need some water, you need light, and you need a bit of patience. And you can easily grow all your salad leaves and radishes and little spring onions
on
your windowsill. And at least you know what's not in it. And you see, I was brought up, I'm the eldest of 9 children, a typical Irish family, and my mother loved to cook, and it was her way of, you know, mummy knew how important it was cooking was for our health, apart from anything else, because she knew that our food should be our medicine, because it was almost pre, I'm 70 years of age now, it was almost pre-antibiotics, not quite, but people knew the importance of feeding children well and of really wholesome, nourishing food. And she used to say, look, if you don't put the money into the food on the table, you'll give it to the doctor or the chemist. And nowadays people, you know, say to me, well, it's all very fine for you, you know, when I advocate, for goodness sake, try and get some chemical-free food or organic food. And people's eyes roll sometimes and they think that, well, it's all right for me because the perception is they think I can afford it. But I say, look, it's not about affording it. It's for some people it is, of course, but for many people it's not about affording it. It's about priorities.
Well, and education.
Yeah, and education. Yeah. And, you know, often I say to people, well, look, okay, so you tell me you can't spend another $50 on getting better quality produce or fresher produce. And I say, well, look, how much did you spend on those nails last week? How much did you spend on the hair, on you know, magazines or whatever? And then we all realise that we all make decisions about what we're going to spend our time and our money on. And food, unfortunately, is a long way down the list of priorities a lot of the time.
Unfortunately. And, you know, yeah. I thought it was just in America, but you mean...
Oh, no, I'm afraid, yeah. But also, and I often say to people, okay, how much did you spend on supplements in the last month? People are prepared to fork out $15, $20 on a supplement or something, and it could be coming from their food.
That's right.
So in a way, and food is such... A wonderful thing to, you know, unite families, to somebody in the house ought to be able to cook, because people get fed up of coming home to the smell of old, you know, reheated something in a microwave. I mean, how wonderful is it to come home, even if it's only occasionally, to the smell of fresh bread wafting out of the oven, or a very simple little stew or something that everybody can sit down around the table to. That's what memories are made of. And I know I sound like an ancient granny, but look, it hasn't changed.
You don't. I mean, I think it's. I think you sound to me like the people who are, you know, preaching this. The new generation.
Yeah.
It's sort of a return to that. Return to that way
yes.
of eating and that way of thinking about our food.
Exactly. There's a craving
now,
to reconnect with how food is produced.
That's right. And you are not a newcomer to this by any means. And you, your show, okay, your television show, you became the famous personality that you are. And
can you imagine a celebrity chef?
And you are. Prior to that, about 20 years prior to that, you came to County Cork to cook.
Yes.
And met your husband at the time.
Yes.
And
still my husband.
And still your husband. I mean, no, yes. That's when you met your husband.
Almost 50 years. Kind of a record.
Well, but, and you met a woman who really changed your life.
Life, exactly. Myrtle Allen, who
is
now my mother-in-law, and sadly went to her a very deserving award. At 96 years of age, she slipped quietly away at the end of last year and left us such a legacy. And of course, she reinforced, when I came to Ballymaloe, which is Ballymaloe House, which is down on the south coast of Ireland, east of Cork, in the middle of a 400-acre farm, very close to the sea. But when I came to Ballymaloe, Myrtle, who had opened a restaurant in their own great big country house in the country. This was in 1964 when, you know, restaurants were in cities and towns. I mean, it was absolutely considered to be some kind of crazy to open a restaurant out in the country, miles away from a central population. But they had a big house. I mean, now there are lots of country house hotels and restaurants, but this was the first one in the British Isles at that time. And she had never had a cooking class in her life. And she just served the kind of food to her guests that she served to her family and friends. And, you know, as a housewife, and that is not a derogatory term as far as I'm concerned, she cooked, you know, if there were lovely fresh cabbages or mackerel or suede turnips or whatever happened to be in season in the garden and on the farm, that's what she put on the table because it was at the best and freshest at that time. And then what she couldn't source, what she hadn't herself on the farm, she, you know, got local farmers or their wives to rear chickens and ducks and geese for her to produce more berries, whatever. So as a result, we've had this incredible network of small producers that we at Ballymaloe House still, and now the cooking school, which I started on a second farm, the cooking school, Ballymaloe Cooking School, is in the middle of a 100-acre organic farm about 2 miles from Ballymaloe, even closer to the sea. And so we still have this amazing network of small producers. And actually in Ireland, I mean, the whole food scene has changed so incredibly in Ireland in the last 30 or 35 years.
From when you started.
From when I started originally, okay. Yes. Yes, and of course we have...
Tell me how.
Marvellous. Well, probably the most exciting thing is the emergence of this artisan food sector and a specialist food sector. So many small artisan producers passionate about what they're doing, making a wonderful cheese or smoking fish or making wonderful jams or preserves, or it could be now, of course, there's a whole fermentation thing coming up as well. So, and it's their whole livelihood. And then there's the farmers markets as well. Actually, of all the things that I've done, I think the thing I'm most proud of is having restarted the market system, the farmers markets in Ireland. After I came over here, actually, to San Francisco and saw the first farmers market, it wasn't even in the Ferry Plaza building at that stage. It was in a parking lot. And I was so excited about it. I mean, I'd seen markets in Europe, of course, but these were different kinds of markets. These were professional people who had moved from the East Coast to the West Coast and in California and started to grow and produce things and then sell them at a farmer's market. And at that time in Ireland, it was a time of great change as well, in the, I suppose, mid-80s at that stage. And basically, we'd gone over, a lot of the supermarkets had come on stream, a lot of them gone over to a central distribution system. So many of the farmers and food producers who used to sell directly to the local shops suddenly found themselves, the local shops, a lot of them were owned by supermarkets, and suddenly the local shops would not buy the local produce. Right. I mean, hello, what was that about?
It's all about distribution.
They had to be efficient. Yeah. So anyway, suddenly local people couldn't get local food. Suddenly here I was standing in this farmer's market in San Francisco, and it was like a light bulb moment. I suddenly thought, if I could restart the markets in Ireland, then local people who wanted local food could get in contact and buy directly from the farmers who were selling it. And so I went back to Ireland the following year, I started the first farmers market in the Cool Quay in Cork. And of all the things I've done, that's the thing I'm most proud of.
And
because many farmers would not be still on the land if it wasn't for the farmers markets.
Right. Yeah.
So originally it was people who were saying, are you crazy? I was on television at the time. And, you know, in Ireland, because of our history, the idea of selling off a stall on the side of the street was considered to be anathema. People thought you'd want to be on your knees. Yeah. And then suddenly when I stood behind my stall myself and encouraged the local farmers and producers and fishermen, basically became the coolest thing. And so the farmers markets are very exciting in Ireland. They're real farmers markets.
But how was the initial reception when you came back with the idea? I mean,
who was the toughest to convince? The real farmers. Because a lot of those the idea of actually setting up a store on the side of the street and selling the produce, they really felt you'd want to be on your knees to do that. So the only reason why it really worked was because I was on television at the time and I was prepared to stand behind a stall and sell produce from our own farm and say, look how beautiful and fresh this is, and look at what Frank Heatherman, the lovely smoked fish he has, and look at what Caroline Robinson has, those beautiful vegetables. And it became super cool. And a lot of the young people, including Clodagh McKenna, who's now doing so brilliantly,
a TV star,
alumni of the Ballymaloe Cooking School.
Students,
yes,
right?
But basically, she started off in the Middleton Farmers Market. She wanted a stall in this, and the Middleton Farmers Market was oversubscribed. So I made a little space for Clodagh on the end of my stall for her to sell her chicken liver patty, and that's where she started her career.
So many wonderful stories.
She then went on to do a television series about the farmers markets and wrote a book, and on it goes, you know.
That's really wonderful, a wonderful experience. And the fact that you use your agency as a star to make these things happen,
Thing, of course, that it did with when I started the Ballymaloe Cookery School, it literally students, because the school is in the middle of an organic farm and we have our own greenhouses and we have chickens and ducks and geese and a micro dairy and all that sort of thing, students literally came from all over the world. again, because they could see how food is produced from the farm to the fork. And I got the opportunity to pass on the skills. I love to pass on, to teach people how to cook. And I got the opportunity to pass on the skills that I had learned from my own mother and from Myrtle, because they reinforced, when I came to Balmaloo from hotel school, Myrtle reinforced my mother's values around food and freshness and all of that.
Getting your hands a little dirty in the dough.
Exactly.
Right?
So now literally students, I mean, at the moment at the cooking school, there's a 3-month certificate course going on there at the moment, and we have 11 nationalities, and that's not unusual. And we're in a very rural part of Ireland. And we also do days and weekends and weeks. And more recently, one of the courses I'm most proud of is a 6-week sustainable food production course, and that's we use all the resources of the farm and the gardens and the greenhouses, and we have amazing speakers. About a third is very inspirational speaker from all over the world, including Patrick Holden, who was the head of the Soil Association and now Sustainable Food Trust. And then we have a third literally putting their hands in the soil, starting with a soil scientist and sowing seeds and learning how to look after animals and all that thing. And then a third in the kitchen, cooking the food, preserving, knowing how to use up a glut and zero waste and all that. So that's one of the things I'm most proud of. But then if people only have a day or an afternoon, if you're in there, if you're over in Ireland and you're in our area, we have afternoon cookery demonstrations literally every afternoon. So you can have a look at the website, cookingisfun.ie, and you can see what's on in that afternoon and drop in. And,
well, so the bad rap that Irish food had for so long in other countries, in America, is not deserved, probably came from poor relatives who immigrated over to America and didn't have the resources, didn't have the food, didn't have the education or the knowledge.
Yes.
But you're telling me that it was always natural. They were always cooking products from the farms.
Our food was very simple, but it was wholesome and nourishing and delicious. And, you know, people didn't have a very wide variety of foods. You know, they would have had bacon and cabbage and parsley sauce and lots of the soda breads and so on.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about some of those dishes in just a moment after we take a quick break.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Serchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Akiko Katayama, and I'm the host of Japan Needs here on HRN. By interviewing fascinating personalities in Japanese culinary culture, I try to demystify Japanese cuisine. My guests have included sake brewers, tea experts, Japanese whiskey experts, and sushi chefs. You can find Japan Needs whenever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, in your new book, Dorina, in the book Simply Delicious, the classic collection, it's just called The Classic Collection, but there are 100 recipes of
classics. Yes, that's right.
Was there one defining feature that made a particular recipe a classic?
Well, it was tough because, you see, we had to pick just 100 recipes from 9 different books. And what I think, in a way, I chose were the recipes that have mostly stood the test of time, or that were sort of recipes that were absolutely associated with me or with Ballymaloe House. And there are things like the traditional salad, you know.
Let me pinpoint a few. Now, first of all, you have to clarify for me. Ballycotton Is that, what is that, the farm?
Ballycotton is a little fishing village about 2 miles from us. And it's okay. All of our fresh fish comes from that little harbour there.
Okay, but Ballymaloe is your whole Ballymaloe, farm, the cooking school.
Ballymaloe is the name of the house and the farm where the original Ballymaloe House restaurant was set. And then the cooking school also carries the name Ballymaloe. And Ballymaloe actually, the name means, these are very old names, it means the town's land of sweet honey. Because all of those names would have entered into the language about 2,000 years ago and would always have reflected some sort of attribute of the area. So obviously...
Sweet honey.
Mal is honey and lua is soft or sweet. So usually it would have meant that there was particularly good honey came from that area.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. We did actually, you've been on A Taste of the Past a couple of different times, mm-hmm. and we did quite a talk about the cookery school. And that didn't entice a lot of people to go, I don't know what would. But now with this book, it's kind of taking a step back because you did have some more progressive dishes in a lot of your other books. I mean, you had, 17 books already?
This is I'm a serial offender.
You got a lot of recipes.
Yes.
But these are... So this is a pared-down version of your recipes, of your repertoire, and of the ingredients. One couple of things. You said the traditional salad. You said if this is a salad that people would have in the evening, and there was something particular about it. Right, you mentioned, tell me about the traditional Irish salad.
Basically, if you kind of went to visit your relatives on a Sunday evening, you might have... In the summer, you might have what they would call salad, and that would be just with what you would call over here Boston bib lettuce, which was the only lettuce we had years ago, some tomato, hard-boiled egg, some little spring onions or scallions, some pickled beetroot, and then with a dressing, pre-mayonnaise days, which is a dressing which was made with... a hard-boiled egg yolk, you'd sieve the hard-boiled egg yolk, chop up the white, and then you'd add in some soft dark brown sugar, which we used to call Barbados sugar, and then a brown malt vinegar and a little salt, and then cream, because...
cream.
And it made the most delicious dressing,
it
actually.
It sounded delicious. Yeah. It looked like... Almost like a Russian dressing to me in the picture.
Yeah.
But the description of the ingredients, I went, a whole different flavor.
It is
flavor.
So good. Actually, the girls are actually going to serve that at King Restaurant on King Street. They're doing a lunch with this book tomorrow. And that was one of the things they chose. But I've actually brought the brown malt vinegar over from Ireland. I'm sure you can get it here.
Yes.
But that's what the brown malt vinegar and the soft dark brown sugar are the key there. But see, this was pre olive oil days in Ireland, and it makes the most delicious dressing. So that was one thing which is definitely a classic. And then if you were visiting your relatives, they might put a couple of slices of the leftover cold meat from their Sunday lunch with it. But we serve it on its own as a starter in Ballymaloe, and absolutely love it.
And anyone else listening to the ingredient list would say, I've got all those things in my cabinet.
Exactly. And this is another thing about my recipes, particularly in this book, they're made with ingredients that people will have,
but
good quality. Exactly. And
then
we would only make that in the summer when the tomatoes were full of flavor and the eggs where the hens were all running around outside. So you had beautiful eggs, and then you had lovely young beetroot that you cooked, and little wispy spring onions, and that good. What we call butter head lettuce, but you call Boston bib.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, when I was a child, was the only thing I knew lettuce was. That's what it was.
Boston bib, that was
yes,
it.
Exactly. Oh. There weren't 10 different varieties like there are now.
From the supermarket.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly.
There was another dish that caught my attention, of course, and I had to look a little, not knowing Ireland, I had to look a little bit in the background to find out what the provenance of this dish was. Dingle pie.
Oh, yes. Dingle is in Kerry.
Okay.
And this is very interesting, actually, because this could even have been a West Cork pie either. But basically, my mother, Noa Myrtle Allen, about 25 years ago, suddenly realised that a lot of our traditional, in inverted commas, dishes, a lot of them were not written down, the sort of things that people would have done at home. And a lot of the older people who were cooking in that way, this was from, 50s and early 60s, were actually, you know, quite old and passing on. So she thought there's a real urgency now in recording these recipes. And so there were no measurements for a lot of them. So she used to write for the Irish Farmers Journal, an Irish farming newspaper. So she started a competition in the newspaper for people to send in their memories or their recipes or just descriptions, even if they didn't have measurements of a particular dish. And every week she would give a prize and a runner-up, you know, and it wasn't about the prize or the prize money, which was, I think, £1 if you won first prize and 25 shillings.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness, you were printed in the Farmer's Journal. And that was, so she got an incredible collection of recipes in around the country, and a lot of them were the sort of things you'd expect, the cold cannons, the champs, the potato dishes, you know, some Irish stews, that kind of thing, and the soda breads and the apple tarts, all that. But then this woman from Kerry sent in a recipe that she described that her grandfather, her grandmother would make for her grandfather, and he would take it in his pocket, the deep pockets of his heavy coat, when he was walking up the mountains to look after the sheep. And it was quite different to anything else. And so it was made, the pastry was made, it was lamb, of course, or mutton, actually, in fact. And she said the pastry was made with the mutton fat and flour and salt and so on.
So it'd be a very sturdy pastry case.
A sturdy pastry case. And then that the chopped up lamb and onion and so on, and pepper and salt, and sometimes a bit of carrot or something, but often not. Anyway, she described this pie, and Myrtle was intrigued by this because she hadn't found anything else like it that had come in. So we made it in the Bamloo kitchen, and it was very interesting, as you quite clearly said. The pastry was fairly rib-sticking, but good and robust. So Myrtle decided we'd change the shortening there. We put butter in, and then actually we added a little cumin to the, which is, was definitely not Irish, but
right.
It's really, you know, sort
trade
of,
roots to the pastry.
Exactly.
There.
And then made this pie, which, of course, we now call Dingle Pie. But the interesting thing was, why was it in that area? And I remember years later, sort of idly listening to a radio program in the background when I was doing something, and suddenly I heard them saying about the tin mines down on around West Cork and then into Kerry, where the Cornish miners had come over to mine the tin, and they'd shown the local people how to mine the tin in the area. And I thought, well, maybe that's the connection, because, you know, the Cornish pasties are such a much loved Cornish food, and I can imagine how maybe a miner who came over might have described to his landlady or his girlfriend how to make these kind of pies, and that, and then perhaps it developed in that area. So,
I mean,
yeah.
And here in America, we call them hand pies.
Hand pies, exactly.
Because you can hold them, yeah.
Hold them in your hand.
Hand.
And, right. And then actually, there's another variation of it in this Stole, another part of Kerry, where this is quite interesting. Mary Keane, who was the wife of J.B. Keane, the playwright, who died a number of years ago, but she told me about these Listowel pies, because there are these Listowel races, the horse races, that were very famous. And of course, the men would all go off to the races and, you know, come home sozzled, drunk, and the wife was supposed to have something for them to eat when they came home. So anyway, their wives then felt very hard done by that they couldn't get to the races because they had to cook. So they all started to make these mutton pies, which they made a couple of days ahead of time, and then they would make broth from the bones of the sheep, and then when they came home from the races, they'd have these pies made with this robust pastry, and then they would heat up the broth and put the pie into a deep sort of wide soup bowl, pour broth over it, the mutton broth over it, and then the men would come in and eat these pies,
so
and
nice,
everybody
nice
was happy.
Soggy, mushy stew.
Perfect, really, just
Rich
what you
again.
Needed after a day of liquid socializing,
yes.
You know.
Yes, indeed. And all originating from the town of Dingle.
Yes, and that was the Listowel one, actually, which, of course, this is all Kerry, still Kerry. And then Dingle pies
Another recipe that caught my eye, but great stories. I mean, the stories are just...
I know.
Honestly, I think you should have included all the stories in the book as well.
I know. Well,
beautiful.
It's always interesting to think how a recipe originated in a particular place. And, of course, with a lot of the traditional dishes, there really is a story behind it.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
The Ballycotton fish pie.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, Ballycotton is the little fishing village about 2 miles from the Ballymaloe Cookery School. And there is a little harbour. It's a little small fishing village with just one street, and the little boats go out and fish. Some day boats, but now some of the boats go further out. And of course, we are so lucky. We get an incredible variety of fish, both flat fish and round fish, and some shellfish. We get crab and lobster and things like that. And we get periwinkles off the strand that we pick and forage on the strand. So that fish pie was just a lovely, simple fish pie, almost like with a bechamel sauce and the fish folded into it. And then with a lovely potato topping on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was beautiful. The picture of it is
everybody
beautiful.
Loves fish pie, don't they? That's a really comforting food, too.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Creamy. Very creamy,
yeah.
Which brings me back to something else.
Yeah.
I was looking at, of course, the book begins with soups, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I said, oh, yes, look at the wonderful green soup and then the potato and leeks.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, that's very Irish. And then I started reading recipe after recipe.
Yeah.
And every soup had not... I said, well, yes, of course, some potatoes to thicken it up a bit. Well, not just potatoes. There's also some cream.
Yes.
And there's also some butter. Every recipe replete with cream and potatoes and butter.
Butter.
I mean, these are meals in a bowl.
Absolutely. And, you know, Ballymaloe House has always been famous for its soups, actually. And a lot of these soups are made on... a formula, a cup of chopped onion, a cup of chopped potato, 3 cups of chopped vegetables, any kind of chopped vegetables of your choice, or it could be pea beans or courgettes, it could be just carrot and parsnip, or it could be just carrot as well as potato and onion. So, and then 5 cups of stock, and then we always... So you cook them together, and we just add usually a little cream at the end, just to give you that wonderful silkiness. And you can have it, of course. You don't have to puree the soups. You can have them with the chunks in it or whatever. But basically, cream, you know, in Ireland, our cream and our butter is wonderful.
Well, and there you particularly being in County Cork.
Yes.
And that's the dairy capital.
Capital,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And we're very favoured by nature in Ireland because we can grow grass like practically nowhere else in the world. We're an island nation, of course, so we have all that coastline with very good, wonderful fish and shellfish. And basically a lot of our dairy products and our meat, our beef and our lamb are incredibly good quality. Actually, in Ireland for a long time, we've kind of taken that for granted, but now we realise that there is a difference in what we produce and what you can buy in other countries.
Yeah, all this talk about the grazing land and having, you know, the animals graze outdoors.
Yes, and of course the cows are grass-fed and the beef is, to a great extent, also grass-fed for most of the year. Usually the animals go in for a short time in the winter for animal welfare reasons. But what did I want to say about that? Oh, yes, but also sometimes... You know, for the last, 4 decades, we've been told that cream and butter and fat and everything is bad for us. I mean, what's that about? There was never a jot of proper research to actually link, fat to cardiovascular disease. And I hope that people realise that now, because I think in a way it's incredibly important for people to realise there are only 2 vitamins that are water-soluble, that's B and C. All the rest of them are fat-soluble. So unless we have a little fat, it could be butter or olive oil or something, with the rest of our food, we can't absorb all the nutrients from the rest of our food.
Such an important lesson.
Incredibly important for people to know, because basically that whole low-fat nonsense was such a myth, and it meant that a lot of people who were on low-fat diets cut out, they found that they were soon suffering from malnutrition.
Well, muscle wasting.
That was all our governments, our Department of Health, our doctors, our nutritionists, everybody kept on repeating the same old nonsense until somebody decided to do a meta-analysis of all the research, discovered there wasn't a jot of... In fact, it was actually injurious to our health.
Yes.
So whatever happens, people should never buy anything low-fat or anything. You just want whole, real food. That's all you need.
And that whole edict of, Everything in moderation.
Everything right. in moderation. Yes. And real, just real food. And there's no doubt about it, we need to cut all the ultra-processed stuff out of our diets. It's killing us. And I'm not using that word lightly.
No,
we just need real food. But it's hard for a lot of people to actually source that kind of food now. Unless they have a very good farmer's market by them, or else unless they start to grow something on their balcony themselves so on. Yeah.
Well, it's no wonder that your television series just flew off the charts. It became so popular.
Thank you.
And those little pamphlet books that went along with the cooking series.
With the Simply Delicious series.
The Simply Delicious series, at that time, they were the highest, best-selling cookbooks ever in print in Ireland before,
Can you imagine? It was a cookbook that made Irish publishing history. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, it was a huge surprise to me and indeed to the RTE and to the publishers. The publisher said, I remember at one stage, she said, my God, this book is selling in telephone numbers. And, they actually were the publishers were not ready for it because they hadn't, I think they published 25,000 copies or something to start with, which was a huge print run, but they ran out of books literally in a couple of weeks, and there was a paper. Anyway, they got them in print again.
So multiple printings later.
but actually, it was interesting. Again, it's back to the fact that, oftentimes people would say to me when they saw the television series, they would say, I felt like when I watched you doing it, I felt like jumping up out of my chair and running straight into the kitchen to do it. And it was very interesting because RTE, our national television station, had... Well, they were hoping it would be a success, but they really had no idea what would happen. And so basically they ran it opposite a very popular soap opera in Ireland and the UK called Coronation Street. And, of course, this was in so many years ago, as you say, 30 years ago, which was when a lot of houses didn't even have a television. And if they did have a television, they had one television. So there was murder in people's houses because, some of them wanted to watch the Coronation Street and the others wanted to watch my television series. So actually, as they say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. So people started to ring into into RTE and into the radio station saying, there's all this kind of aggro in the house, can they not repeat the series? So they repeated the series immediately, put it on at prime time, and because of all the arguments in people's houses.
Amazing.
So it's another era, when there was only one television, and there was certainly not, it was such a long time before any kind of iPhones or anything like that.
Well, talk about being in the right place at the right time.
Well, it's
funny. In today's television landscape, and my goodness, if you're lucky to get an appearance on someone else's show, much popular cooking show.
I know.
And how
will think I'm out of the ark when I'm talking about a time when there was only a black and white television in the house. Yeah.
Well, in Ireland, because you were a little behind in the television world.
Yeah.
But how did someone, a publisher or somebody, go looking for this program, or did they come to you and say, oh, you should be on television?
The reason why RTE originally did it was because they were getting a lot of criticism because they had no Irish person doing a television series. And they had a well-known brand of spices that they'd bought a series about, and it was obviously outright marketing. And in fact, the person who initiated the program originally had been on the switchboard in RTE one night when this program from a well-known spice company was on, and suddenly the switchboard lit up with people ringing in and saying, for goodness sake, can you not find an Irish person to do a program rather than this overt publicity for a spice program, spice company.
Right.
And she sent a memo to the controller of programs next day. She told me this story herself and said, for goodness sake, would you get onto them down there in Ballymaloe and ask, is there anybody who would do a pilot? Surely with the Ballymaloe Cooking School already going and Myrtle at Ballymaloe House, between them, there must be somebody who could do a series. And then they contacted us, and that's how it happened. And I remember when one day this letter came from RTE saying, would you like to do a pilot? And I'd never seen a television camera in my life at that stage. And I was looking at this letter thinking, oh my God, I can't do that. I make such a fool of myself. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe if I did it. And then, oh no, I can't do it. And this went backwards and forwards. And in the end, I decided that it would be better to have a go, even if it wasn't a great success, rather than live with, well, what if? Right. And I always say that right. to people, look, have a go. And, you know, it's experience, even if it doesn't turn out to be exactly what you meant, whatever it is. You never know in your life what's a little thing that can change the course of the rest of your life.
Well, certainly it was fortuitous that you decided to make a go at it, because you were perfect for it. And well, it shows in the sales of the books. And it shows your continued success on appearances and television. You have so many television appearances and filming and different videos on television. And the series of books, 17 books to your credit. And now with your newest one, just reliving that time, Simply Delicious, a classic collection. You are a classic, Dorina. And thank you so much for spending your time to share all your stories with us. You are a natural storyteller. Beautiful. Wonderful.
Well, Linda, it's great to get together again. Yes, thank you very much for having me on.
And we'll
do
it again. Next time it'll be from Ballymaloe.
Oh,
I
good.
I promise you.
Promise,
okay,
promise.
I do. Okay. And thank you for listening. This has been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, good radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.